This is the second session of DNS Working Group. I'm Jim Reid, one of the co-chairs, and I think most of you already know that. Just one or two simple administrative things before we get started. For the benefit of those who are out in webland, who are listening to this on Jabber sessions and webcasts or whatever, please use the mics when you have any comments to make, and please identify yourself as part of that process. This is just so it's part of the overall record, and those who are not in the room will know what's going on. I would also ask you to please make sure that any mobile phones and pagers are put onto stun mode, so we don't get people's phones ringing off in the middle of the meeting if we possibly can avoid it. We have our JabberScribe, we have our minute taker, Adrian, who's on his 10th anniversary, part two. Thanks for that. We've got a very nice lady here doing the stenography and the real-time transcriptions. Thank you for that. So, without any further ado, let's get down to the rest of the agenda for today. First item is an update from our friends at the NCEC about what they've been doing with DNS recently, and Anand is first up. Anand.
Thanks. Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Anand Buddhadev, DNS Services Manager at the RIPE NCC, and I'm going to do a quick update on what we've been busy with since RIPE 55. First, just a quick introduction. There have been several changes with the DNS team in the last year. We've got some stability now. There's myself, DNS Services Manager, and Shurd, who's on the left, to my right, that is, and Wolfgang Nagler from Austria. So that's the team. First, just a very quick overview of the services that we manage within our little department. We handle reverse DNS delegation for the IPv4 and IPv6 space that is allocated from the RIPE NCC. We also provide secondary DNS service for several ccTLDs. And we also operate 17 instances of the kroot root server. We are also responsible for the technical operations of the E164.ARPA zone, which is also known as the ENUM zone. We also operate an AS112 node at AMP6. And finally, we are also responsible for DNS for the forward zones of the NCC, and that is RIPE.NET and the related zones. So this is a graph of the sort of query rates that we see at our reverse DNS services. There are three colors here, and these represent the three busiest of our servers. The bottom one in red is known as ns.ripe.net externally, and this is the server that acts as a secondary for many of the /16 allocations that we have. Above that, in orange-brownish color, is NSPry, which is responsible for answering queries for several of the forward zones, including the ENUM zone. And the one in yellow is NSSEC, which handles queries for several zones that we secondary. As you can see, we receive in excess of 50,000 queries per second on an average day. Some numbers about our reverse and forward zones and DNSSEC numbers. As you can see, the number of zones hasn't changed since RIPE 55. However, the number of signed zones has gone up by one, and this is due to the ENUM zone, which we signed in November. And some NS record numbers there for you, and some DS record numbers. These have gone up slightly since RIPE 55. A little bit about ENUM operations. ENUM operations are quite stable. We signed the zone way back in November 2007, and since the 25th of March, we've been accepting secure delegations. I did a separate presentation about this in the ENUM working group, so I won't go into any more detail here. We move on to K-root operations. We still have 17 instances. There's been no change in numbers since the last meeting. However, we have been very, very busy upgrading the OS on all these instances. We've upgraded to CentOS version 4. We've upgraded to NSD 2.3.7, which is the latest stable one that we use. And during peak periods, we get approximately 16,000 queries per second across all the instances. The little graphic at the bottom of the page shows you some colors. You can see some huge bands. The one in green is represents the instance at Lynx, which gets about 6,000 queries a second. And the other colors represent all the other various instances. One very important change since RIPE 55 has been the introduction of K-root's quad A address into the root zone. And this happened on the 4th of February, 2008. This graphic actually shows you exactly when this happened. Up until the 3rd of February, there was a background hum of queries coming over IPv6. This was probably coming from resolvers where K-root's IPv6 address had been hard-coded by hand. And on the 4th of February, when the address was introduced, the query rate went up steeply and stabilized at approximately 120 queries per second. Most of these queries actually come to our instance at M6. Which is the best IPv6 connected instance that we have. As you can see, the sky hasn't fallen down, everything's stable, and the introduction of IPv6 addresses for the root server has not caused any operational problems, and everything's just working fine. So, some more information about our instances. At the moment, we have 5 instances that are announcing our IPv6 prefix, 2 of our global nodes in Amsterdam and Miami. They're announcing a /32 prefix, and the local nodes that we have in Athens, Geneva, and Budapest are announcing a /48, of course with no export set, so their reach is only local. And if anyone here would like to peer with us over IPv6, please do get in touch with us at dns-help@ripe.net. This graph shows query rates from a more recent period, from 2 weeks ago. The rate has gone up a little since the 4th of February. We're now at about 140 queries per second peak time. We haven't done extensive analysis on the queries coming in, but we have had a look, and most of the queries are just standard. There's not much garbage. And a lot of the queries actually originate from one particular provider in Germany who appear to be running a cluster of mail servers over IPv6. And these often do reverse lookups over IPv6. What we've also been busy with is trying to think about K-root's traffic engineering. It's been quite stable, unchanged since it was originally established, but we think that it's time that we make some improvements to it. The current status is that we announce a /24 prefix from all the instances. M6 also announces a /23 covering prefix, and this is to cover for the situation where a customer of a provider who peers with one of our local nodes will otherwise see a black hole to K-Root. To ensure that our local nodes are preferred over the global nodes, we prepend K-Root's AS number 25152 two or three times from the global nodes. And at local nodes, we have no export set. This approach has some drawbacks that we have been seeing and we have experienced. The inconsistent AS path leads to unbalanced query loads. Our prefix announcements are also uncolored at the moment, which means that when we want to debug issues with this Anycast network, it's sometimes a little difficult to see which prefix is being originated from which instance. And of course, if the announcement from AMP6 disappears and the covering prefix goes away, then we black hole some customers. So we're trying to solve some of these issues, and this is a little graphic that shows you this problem. We've looked at the source addresses from our Delhi instance, and what's interesting to see is that a lot of these queries come from the United States. These should really be going to our instance in Miami, but they're not. So this is an example of some of the discrepancies we see, and we want to fix them. And the way we want to do this is to do away with the path prepend, which will allow BGP to automatically select the nearest node. We want to announce the /23 covering prefix from all the global nodes and withdraw the /24 from the globals and only announce the /24 from the locals. And we also want to attach the IP address of the unicast address of the local K-root instances so that the routes are colored and we can track them more easily. One of the other things that we've been doing is DNS lameness checks. We've been doing these for the past 7 months. The code is now production quality and runs once a month. We have data from the last 7 months that we've been collecting, and the information is published on the RIPE NCC website. And we're now working on finalizing the next phase, where we will actually be sending emails out to all the contacts to notify them that their servers are lame for particular zones. And the target for this is July this year. This is an example of a template that we're going to use to send the email messages out. I'm not sure you can all read it from back there, but it basically just sends out a notification to say that a particular contact, this message is sent out to a particular contact to tell them about the zones that they're responsible for and that the zones are lame. Here are some statistics from the last few lameness checks that we've run. The green bit shows the servers that are working fine. The red bits show servers that are lame. The average amount of lameness is about 9.5%. Some zones, such as 86.inaddr.arpa, have very little lameness, only 2.2%. And a couple of zones, which are actually quite tiny, with just a handful of servers, are showing 100% lameness. And there are approximately 5,000 unique contacts in our database at the moment. That means about 5,000 emails will be sent out. The RIPE NCC operates secondary DNS service for CCTLDs, and we've been doing that free of charge on a best effort basis up until now. One of the potential problems with this is competition with our members. Our members have made it very clear to us that we should start phasing this service out, and we've done that for 5 zones last year, and we are continuing with this process. .LT has been phased out in April, and we're pursuing phasing out of .IE, .HK, .RO, and .SK. So what are our future plans? We want to finalize the lameness checking project and start actually sending emails out to people to tell them to fix their servers. We are also busy with hardware end-of-life, replacing servers. We are still pushing ahead with improved IPv6 peering for K-Root as well as Transit. We're talking to a few people about the K-Root Anycast infrastructure. One problem that we've discovered in our software has been that the provisioning tools do not support zone transfers over IPv6. So if any of our members are running IPv6 only on their name servers, then our server ns.ripe.net can't do zone transfers. So this is something we want to fix soon after this RIPE meeting, which will make all our DNS services completely IPv6 compliant. And finally, we're reviewing our DNSSEC infrastructure, which is now approximately 2 years old, a little over 2 years old, and we want to replace the servers, the software, and review all our policies and procedures. So that's it from me. Any questions?
Thank you, Anand. Are there any questions?
Lars Lehmann from Autonomica. Just one quick question, since I don't remember. The lameness project, for which domains do you run these tests?
We're running lameness checks against all the slash eights allocated to the NCC from IANA. So we're running lameness checks against the...
And under those.
And under them,
okay.
Yeah.
All right,
yeah.
Thanks.
Okay.
No more questions for Anand? Okay.
Thank you, everyone,
for
listening.
Thank you very much. Next up, we have a presentation on Unbound. Well, you've got the T-shirts at the back of the room here, so now let's see what Will Wouter has to say about this new DNS implementation from NLNet Labs.
The second one? Is that the second one? Yeah.
I'll give you, we've got flashcards for 10 minutes, 5 minutes to go, just to let you know how time's going.
Okay, thanks. Can you start it for me? So hi, I'm Wouter Weingaerts. I work at NLNet Labs, and I'm here to present to you Unbound, a new validating caching resolver.
Can you get me back of the room?
Okay. I'll do it like this. So, Unbound, validating caching resolver. I'm from NLNet Labs. What am I going to talk about? I'm going to talk to you about why another resolver, why do this, the introduction. Then I'll briefly skim over the features. Resolver's got lots of features. We don't want too many, but you need some. For example, trust anchors, authority service, the modern paranoid resolving. I'll briefly skim over the elegant design that we're trying to have, and then I'll go into the testing that it's received and hopefully convince you that it's real good. And I'll end with a summary. So why did we make another resolver? Well, basically, in the DNS, there aren't that many open source validators right now. You've got Bind, and this is going to be the alternative choice to having a Bind validator, as well as being an alternative choice for having a resolver, and thus having more code diversity out there. And you know, if one implementation gets struck with some sort of horrible bug, then the other one doesn't get struck with the bug, and this is makes the world a safer, better place, and as well as interoperability and things like that. So where do we envision deployment? We envision deployment on your workgroup local or just your local host DNS resolver or validator. At large ISPs, and a couple of them are actually using them already, and as a validating library for applications, for having it as a stub in your application to do the validation right in there. And then at Labs, if you don't know us, we're a not-for-profit, public benefit, tax-deductible foundation. We already developed NSD, Name Server Daemon, which is a DNSSEC aware, high performance, authoritative name server. And NSD doesn't do recursion at all. So this product does recursion, but not authority. Yeah, that's the idea here. So we've tried to keep some of the experience and good ideas from NSD and use them while building the Unbound thing. Of course, Unbound has existed for a long time already. This is not actually, I mean, I'm presenting it as a new product because it's available for use right now. But it's been developed quite an extensive time ago and thought of by the good people from VeriSign, EP.net, Nominet, and Kirai. And they basically built a Java prototype that, because of the clean architecture, was used to try out the different ways of doing DNSSEC and other stuff. And in early 2007, we came around and we said, okay, we'll go and make a solid C version, which is like, you know, production ready, and we can take on the maintenance. So the first version was available January, but there is a current release candidate. It's called 0.11, and somewhere within the next month or so, this is going to be called 1.0, and I'll change the version number string in there. If you want to get a preview of the version, you can just download it right now. We've had substantive testing by our beta testers from Switch, .cz, Access for All, and IIJ, for which many thanks. And so what are the features that, you know, we have? Well, this is the basic features, because a resolver needs a couple of things to deliver the service, and a modern resolver. So we've got IP4 and IP6, dual stack support, and IP6 only, IP4 only. We've got access control, so you can configure this thing to not be an open recursor. It's got DNSSEC validation. It's got NSEC3, and we're ready to do the SHA-256 as that's going to happen. It ships with the useful tools for system administration, something to check your configuration before you use it, a utility to do a single validation to see if your validation is working. Very important, we've also made some good documentation. So there's men pages that are readable and have text that you can understand. There is a website with documentation and ease of use, and the code's been extensively documented as well. The Doxygen, which is like a Java doc type of tool. We have a feature, well, it's not entirely basic, to have thread support. So if you want, you can enable threads. You don't have to, but you can. And use multiple CPUs to scale your performance if you want to do that. So these are just what I would say. Just, you know, if you want to make a validator, you need to do this. Otherwise, but then Unbound's got some more. So two things I wanted to highlight are Trust Anchor features and Authority Servers. So Trust Anchors are, of course, very important to a validator. And you've heard earlier today and yesterday talks about TARs in RIPE and IANA, Trust Anchor repositories. Well, somehow you've got to get them in the validator, and I've tried to build as many possible ways to get them in there and ease of use. So it's possible to enter many Trust Anchors in the case that, you know, there is no root signing, then many islands, it can cope with that. If there is, you can just enter the DDS or the DNS key for the root itself. We can read zone format, or we can even read the bind format keys, not the rest of the configuration file, just the keys out of a bind file. Anything to get to make it easier for you to enter the key in this in the validator. Another conscious choice has been authority service. So it's largely absent as much as possible. We wanted to avoid complicating the program with, you know, feature bloat. However, it's necessary to have some sort of authority service, mainly for the draft reverse zones. So this is to be able to block outgoing reverse to like 10/8 and that sort of thing. To be able to serve your local host 127.0.1 record and that sort of thing. It was just really tiny just enough to do that job. You can block domains as well with that, which is what ISPs need nowadays. As well, if you really need to have some sort of a local, your own local zone at your site, you can use a stub zone to refer to that, to a real authority server, and in that way have your, and have a clean separation between your authority and recursive server. Yes? Okay. Another feature for modern resolvers is paranoia. This is completely free. This is where, this is what you get. This is what you get when there is no DNSSEC. Yeah, DNSSEC, you've got keys. There's no need for paranoia because the signature validated. If you don't get a signature, all you can be is paranoid. Well, we do the paranoia as the RFCs tell us to do. RFC 2181 is a trust model where, if you get some sort of a little glue address attached into some reply, then you're not going to trust that just by default. It's going to there's a ranking between the trust. We filter out of bailiwick glue, if you know what that is. We'll do that. We do all the recommendations from the recent forgery resilience draft. We've got a strong random number generator, so it's a cryptographic random number generator, not a one that's doing some easy modular function in a weird number space. So we've got query name matching, source port randomization, as well as source address randomization if you're multi-homed, and we do RTT banding as well. And we even have a OX20 experimental in case you want to, you know, get even more out of your forgery resilience. So this is so that if you don't have DNSSEC, it's going to be a good quality secure resolver as well. That's the point. So the main design of Unbound was envisioned from the start off, from the Java prototype, to be easy and have a nice and configurable modules. And I've tried to keep that design as much as possible. Although this is not Java, this is, I say, ancient quality C, portable anywhere. So the basic design to have threads work is to have worker threads, and every thread is like a fully capable resolver in itself. But they have a shared cache that they can access, and the cache is an LRU modern cache, so it's efficient. And you can set the memory use of your cache to be anything from 1 megabyte to, you know, a couple gigabyte, if whatever your machine does by default is it's something reasonable. And the basic idea is that there is a query coming in on the left-hand side, and then it'll enter a sort of a query mesh, which is like the recursive dependencies of one query upon another. And every query has got a little state machine associated with a couple of modules, and it'll pass through the validator, and the validator is going to go like, well, let's, you know, get out this chain of trust and do its validation, and it passes on its request to the iterator module. And you just, the iterator module is doing the entire recursion thing, the what you think of as a recursive resolver. It's going to go like, oh, well, there's name servers out there, send queries to them, get the reply, see if we need to chase down delegations, and that sort of thing. And it's going to then make outgoing queries towards the authoritative servers on the internet, or forwarders, or however you've configured your setup here, and once it gets the replies, use the infrastructure cache to store lameness and timeouts and stuff like that, and then pass it back to the validator, who is going to use its key cache and its data cache, message and error set cache in there, and then it'll be passed back to the client, and then the next query will be answered straight from that cache. And we're storing not just the RAR sets, we're also storing the format of the message in a separate message cache, so we don't need to actually assemble a message when a query arrives. We just know the format and the data already, and we can just quickly reply to that. So that's the basic design in there. And the modules are designed to be easily replaceable and changeable. So it's, for example, you can take out the validator already in the current version, and what you get is something that doesn't validate, but it's a recursive server. And it's possible to add extra modules in there as well. So the idea is to be extensible and have a clean makeup. Now that, you know, in building this C version, I thought, okay, this is going to be a good version. I need this to be really stable and solid. So I've done extensive testing on this. The first class of testing is regression tests, or as you call them, maybe unit testing. And unit testing is a sort of code that's handling wire format, and it's handling key signature encodings and stuff like that. That's part has been unit tested. As well as there has been, I think, a reasonably unique feature, although you don't know what the other, you know, resolvers do. There is a test infrastructure where we can where you can present a synthetic or a captured trace towards Unbound, and then see how the state machines handle this. And it's been used to test, you know, all the little states of the state machines and make sure they all do what they're supposed to do in all these different cases that you can get, because in DNS you can have really you know, weird corner cases with C names and whatnot. And there's been basic functionality tests, which you would expect us to do, yeah, to actually start the thing and do queries to it and see that you get the right answer. We've also asked some beta testers. I've already named them, and there is a couple more that people that have really helped us test this in real ISPs and real user queries, which has been very, very useful, because apparently the users don't notice because they get the right answers. So the other part of this is performance tests, because we would like this to be a high performance server, but, you know, how do you know? Well, from the start off, I've tried to code this thing as a high performance server using the experience we have from NSD, but of course this is a resolver, so, you know, resolver's got two kinds of performance. It's got cache performance, and it's got like recursion performance. And of course, when you do recursion, you have to send queries to somewhere else. So it's going to be lower than the cache performance by orders of magnitude, just because a query somewhere else is going to take milliseconds to do, whereas your memory is like nanoseconds. And the problem with recursion performance is that, you know, you can run it now against the internet, but that's not entirely fair, because if you run it again, the internet will be completely different, possibly. You know, somebody might have tripped over a wire somewhere, and you're, you know, it's going to be different. So I've tried to make a setup where we have a known stable environment, so the tests are fair and comparable. So I've extended the test lab that we have at Ananet Labs to work on resolvers. And what you've got is the recursor in the middle here. That's the important part. You've got the server, the recursive caching server, and it's been given a couple of root hints. Like, you can configure any of the resolvers out there in the market. You give them root hints, and we point them towards some sort of internet, which is basically served by three servers that we have on the local subnet, one called root, one called TLD, and one called SLD, that is serving a little internet there. And then we play back a number of queries towards it using TCP replay on a computer, and with a spoofed return address, so they all end up, the answers to that end up at a little listening, a little capture device that's going to get all the answers. And by having the authority servers basically serve a large amount of domains of the form, like www.example.com, but then with lots of different names in there, we have some sort of something reasonably close to the real world, but then stuffed in a known environment. And these are all different computers, so the actual caching server is not bothered by any of our testing equipment. It can just run on there and go. So what does it do? Well, first there is cache performance. So this is a bit of a lots of lines in the graph. I'll start at the top, which is the easy bit. This is the Echo Daemon. So
this thing is just showing you the system performance out there. So this is just showing the system performance out there. So actually, our system is performing up to like 60,000 queries a second, and then it's going, the system is dropping down, and Echo Daemon is, of course, not do, Echo Daemon doesn't do recursive resolving. It's just echoing the query back,
and we see if it can actually do that. So at the end, this is going to stop. Then next on, we've got the green line, which is NSD. Well, NSD is not a recursor either, but to make it fair, we've loaded all of the zones. Basically, it's like if NSD were authoritative for the entire internet, and it would have the answer already. So it's giving the correct answer and sending that back as fast as possible. Then you have this, the performance indicated by the green line. And this is all cache performance. So in the blue line, the dark blue line, you can see unbound. And it's got the entries in its cache, and it's responding from the cache. So it's pretty similar to what NSD is doing, apart from NSD being authoritative and unbound, getting it from the cache. And you can see the performance is very close as well, which is, of course, the goal. And we can't actually win from NSD here, which is because NSD is doing zone pre-compiling, if you know NSD. A recursor can't do that because the data is going to be changing all the time. So we're just a slightly bit slower than NSD in there. And then further on in the graph, you can have here PowerDNS 3.1.4, the latest version I could get from their website, which is, in the exact same situation. It's getting a short burst to get the information in the cache. And then we start querying the cache at a really high rate and see how much it can still answer. How many queries can it still answer? For example, at 40,000 queries a second, the cache response is about 40%, right? So you get 40% of the queries get an answer. And the light blue line below that is bind. The latest version I could get from the website is 9.4.2, which I heard is just a version which I heard is just a little bit faster than 9.4.1 or something. So that's nice. So the basic picture here is that unbound is close to NSD in the cache performance. And PowerDNS and bind are a bit slower, but also reasonably close to each other, with PowerDNS just leading a little bit ahead. I'll tell you about our server setup. We're serving using Ubuntu on a good old Athlon 2400 Plus, which is about, 1.6 megahertz. Using gigabit Ethernet cards on a gigabit switch. The important bit in this slide that you want to see, it's a bit high for me, is at the 95 percentile over there. That's where you want your performance to be. Yeah? You want to have 95% of your users to get an answer. So if you want to compare these things, look over there, the little bending point. It's going all right at 100%, and then it sort of bends down a little, and then it sort of drops real fast. So you want to be at the start of that drop, and then see, sort of compare your numbers. And if I sort of look at that, I think, looks like twice as fast as the, looks like unbound is about twice as fast as the bind or power DNS values. But you can get a bit better values if you look closer. So, of course, there's also recursion. And recursion is, of course, looking very different. For one thing, the system is able to keep up much more because it doesn't have to, because echoing the query doesn't need to send queries somewhere else, so it's that'll keep up. How do we force recursion? Let's first tell you that. There are many people doing different things here. We force recursion by having unique queries. Every query is different from every other query. So it can't be in your cache because it's a new query. But it is possible to cache the name servers. It's possible to cache like the .com server and do that. And it's the same setup otherwise. What you see here is unbound here in the dark blue, and the same version of PowerDNS and bind below that. And you can see it's a bit closer together, which is probably because they need to query the same authority server served by NSD. Get their answer before they can get a reply out there. They're all the same shape. They start out nice, then there is there's a sudden dip that goes down, and then it starts to smooth out at the end. Yeah, smooth out at a sort of, I don't know, towards some sort of stable value, it seems to be. So here again, it's the 95 percentile value that's the most important. If you want to say things like, gosh, it's twice as fast as the other one, well, I did some testing where I just tried different query types. So here below, I've got different types of queries I'm doing. And at the top, you can see I'm just using QueryPerf, you know, which is a small program that floods your server with queries and counts the number of replies. I've used the three different versions of recursors here. And you can see the quick takeaway is like, you know, unbound in the yellow seems to be faster, nice and fast, yeah, than the other ones with a usually power DNS leading over bind, with an interesting dip here, where on Linux domains, power DNS seems to, you know, suddenly get a performance drop, which is really there. I tried several times. And the other takeaway is that if you want to sort of say something with statistics, then using a different query type could be really interesting for your marketing department. But other than that, you know, this is not really fair. I think the previous slides were much fairer in their setup, but this just shows that different query types and different setups can really affect the outcome. But at least Unbound's performing well, and that's what I wanted to show. So in summary, we've got Unbound. It's a validating caching resolver. It's got an open source license. It does DNSSEC. It's standard compliance. It's got nice performance. We port to everything POSIX. You'll get support by NLNet Labs, which we announce our draw port change and support 2 years in advance. You can get 0.11 at unbound.net. And if you have any questions, please ask. There are T-shirts right over there. These ones.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Roberts.
I just want to know
for the benefit of those in Redland, what's your name?
Robert Martin from the DK.
Thank you.
You mentioned a lot about the trust anchor repositories and stuff and managing a lot of keys.
Yes.
Can you also facilitate DLV, like if IANA were to set up one of those?
If IANA were to set up one of those?
Yeah, could you actually use it? Like saying that you wanted to use it?
Because DLV doesn't really scale to large values, so I didn't implement this at this time. But if it were to be necessary, then I would implement whatever is necessary to get keys in there.
Yeah, okay. But in terms of DNSSEC, it seems to be a little bit the way that people might be going if you want DLV trust anchors for TLDs. Well, IANA's DLV only deals with
the
TLDs.
So the trouble with DLV is that it's not very well in performance, and it doesn't scale up in number of entries in a DLV very nicely, as far as I know.
Peter Janssen, .eu registry, amongst others. Could you quickly go back to the slide with your first graphs, if you would do that?
This one?
This is probably strictly not really related to the things you have been doing, but which has been bugging me for quite some time. If you look at the red ones, which is the most performant one, there's a drop at 60,000 per second somewhere, right? You start losing queries.
So basically the system, the operating system, TCP stack stops
Did you do more investigation of what is really happening? Is it indeed the operating system? Is it CPU? Or is it number of interrupts per second, for instance, on your network card?
I did look closely at that. Although I'm not really trying to get the highest possible numbers on these machines, no. They're pretty old by design to have that. I've seen more than 100,000 queries a second on some new hardware, but it seems to be highly related to your device driver for Ethernet card.
Mm-hmm.
And then it'll be like, are you using FreeBSD, TCP stack, or are you using the Linux one, which will be a bit of a difference, but also the device drivers. If you have a bad driver, that's going to cause massive interrupts, then that might be
but that means
different.
When you look at the green and the blue ones and all the rest, when you start dropping or losing queries, it's really not hardware or any other thing related. It's really CPU bound in that case then.
Yes. Okay. Yes, there is plenty of gigabit Ethernet there, of bandwidth.
Okay.
And you can see that it's got the same shapes are just repeated here, smaller. where the system is sort of, the system performance is being reflected.
Yeah.
Okay. I think we have time for one more question. Ralph?
Ralph Weber, Colt Telecom. I have actually a few questions. So first you said that you do source address randomization. That does mean if you have multiple addresses on the box, you can query from different addresses.
Yes.
Is it also possible to configure that? Because if you have an Anycast instance, it's not very kind of a good idea to source from an Anycast.
Yes. So basically, it came out of the configuration. So it's got the configuration option to sort of contact the authority service from a different source address than contacting the clients. And if you give more addresses to contact the authority service with, it'll start doing source address randomization on that.
Okay, good, thanks. The other is statistics you have only have either cache or then recursion performance. Have you also done kind of real world tests where it's something like 40 to 60% from cache and the rest is recursions, and how unbound compares there? And on that, have you actually compared against nominum CNS?
Well, I don't have a nominum CNS at all. I don't have that, so I can't compare with it. It would be interesting in the results, but it's not open source, so I can't. I have no clue. Other than that, it would be interesting, but I think that it's just a take 60% of the one performance number and add 40% of the other number, and that's going to be the result.
Well, might be. I'm not convinced
it could
that
be
will be the result,
yes,
because
obviously
the server has different things to do.
Well, for unbound, that would be the result, because unbound is doesn't there. That this is just the way unbound is made. But I guess for other resolvers, they could be doing weird stuff. Yeah.
Okay, folks. I think that's it. We've run over time. Thank you very much, Wouter. Next up, we have André Cherie. I hope I've pronounced his name correctly.
No.
No. Sorry. He's going to tell us what the Czech Republic's been up to with Cyrifo.cz. Sudi. Sudi. Sorry. André? Sorry, Sudi.
Okay, thank you. Hello, my name is André Cherie, and I'm from Czech Domain Registry. This will be just a quick update on what we have done on DNSSEC in past month. So I don't want to spend your time for lunch. So, well, you may already heard on Enum Working Group that we signed the Enum Zone, and we also did a secure delegation. And we were first, the Polish Zone was published. The secure delegation was published a day after us. Well, we assign on every generation or weekly, whatever comes first, because there are not many changes in the Enum zone. We are using the RIPE-DZ tools. I had to make some changes to the Perl code, and I sent those patches to Olaf. Thanks to Olaf for those tools. And we plan to switch the signing to hardware security modules after we make them work. So for the .cz, we are not so brave to do anything yet. So we are waiting for the hardware security modules and, well, the things to settle down with the Enum. So we have everything tested and in place. Right now, we have two cards for testing. One is the Sun Cryptographic Accelerator 6000, whatever. And that's the card we are going to use for zone signing key. And the second one is Encipher and Shield F3500. And this one will be used for the key signing keys storage and signing of the keys. Let's talk about why. Well, for the Sun card, it's very fast, it's very cheap, but it works only on Solaris and some old version of Red Hat and SUSE. The keys can be protected only by password, and there are only a few ciphers available at the card. But it's Well, it's very fast and very cheap. And we think that it's enough for the zone signing keys, just to buy a few of those cards and put them into the servers. What we have done is we can generate the keys thanks to Richard Lamp and his patch for Bind. And right now we cannot sign the zone because we are stuck on some PKCS11 function doing some weird stuff. I will have to debug that after I get back. And I think we will have this ready this month. So I will send some update to the list. The Encipher Endshield is a card which is more secure. It has secure card certificate storage. It's for I principle. I think that you can store the certificate on the private part on more than two cards. So you can have more people generate the key signing key and sign these zone signing keys. It also supports more ciphers, and more platforms are supported. And well, we are trying to make it run on Ubuntu Linux. It's slightly slower and well more expensive, but well, it comes with the certification and the secure cards. What we can do with this card, we can use the PKCS11. And that DNSSEC keygen and signzo doesn't work yet, but we received the card just before I went here, so I hope we will have this ready also this month, so we can start real testing. Any questions? Sorry for Ripe, I borrowed the picture, I like it.
Hi, my name is Roy Adams. I work for Nominet. We've been basically doing the same thing using the SCA 6000 cards. What we have been looking at is using the engine. How do you say that?
OpenSSL?
In OpenSSL.
Yeah, we were thinking about this too.
Okay. There is, if you contact, for instance, ISC, there is a preliminary version out there, it's a Bind 960 alpha, that has support for these kind of things.
Cool.
It might save you a lot of work.
Okay, thank you.
Another question is, if you do this directly through PKCS11 calls, why would you actually want to do hashing on the box or hashing on the card? Because hashing in software can be just as fast. It's the signing you want to do on the card, I think.
Well, I didn't run the test, but I suppose that the hashing on the card will be faster, at least for the Sun Crypto card. I hope so.
Okay. So, if you're interested, let's talk after the session.
Okay.
Yeah. Thanks.
Next.
Lars Lehmann, Autonomica. Have you been thinking about signing policies at all? These zones, regeneration periods, key validity periods and stuff like that?
Yes. We used the best current practice document for DNSSEC or it's just RFC, I don't know right now. But well, we have some document written about the policies and the rotation, the keys and compromises and whatever.
Found that these periods and resigning policies have a large impact on the zone transfers between master and slave servers. So it can really have a huge impact on the amount of data you have to transfer between these. So you need to take that into account as well.
Yeah. We have IXFear in place for all those slave servers. So, well, but yes, I'm thinking about that it will slow down the updates on the slave servers.
Any more questions? I have one myself while Peter's coming to the mic. Andre, the Lehman was asking about your policies being documented and written down. Would these be in English or in Czech? Or could
well,
be made
it's
available?
It's in Czech at the moment.
Okay.
But I think we will document it in English after we make everything work.
Yeah, so. I think it would be helpful if we could then try and get some kind of common, a common set of documents about how various TLDs are considering policies for DNSSEC, and then try to distill from that best practices and all stuff like that.
I think I saw some wiki somewhere.
Mm-hmm, yeah.
But I was trying to get access to that and I was not able to, but I didn't spend that much time.
Okay.
With that.
I think Peter has a question. Yeah.
Okay, since I already have two microphones.
Okay.
Peter Koch, Dienik, just a short clarification question. Is NSEC 3 a concern for you?
Not for the enum. But for .cz, yes.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Andrej. Our next speaker is Carsten Strutman. At least I can pronounce his name correctly. From Men and Mice. And he's going to give us an update on some interesting properties of the Microsoft DNS implementation or DNS implementations. Carsten.
Yes, hello. My name is Carsten Strutman from Men and Mice. I would like to show you a little bit of information notes I have on what is new in the new Microsoft Windows operating system in regards to DNS. We see more and more enterprise customers migrating away from Unix DNS and using Microsoft DNSs in the internet. So knowing what's out there and knowing what is different from other DNSs out there might be beneficial. Just a quick question to the audience. Is someone here who is running a Windows DNS server as an authoritative or caching DNS server directly in the internet, not in an internal network, but in the internet? Don't be shy.
Oh, come on, you're nice friends.
Okay, I don't want to go over everything. It's just for completeness, everything in there. So things that I skip over, you can look after that in the slides. So the first big change is the global name zone, which is in there. And the global name zone is an idea to go away with WINS and NAT-BT, that is name resolution for single label names. That has been the Windows operating system since the beginning. And that was a much problem in troubleshooting name resolution issues in these networks that have both DNS and have WINS enabled. What is now in there is a special zone that you can configure in Windows 2008 DNS, which is called the Global Names Zone. And it works that way, I show you. Here we have a normal DNS zone, might be an Active Directory integrated or might be just a static zone. Here it is called ad.firma.example, and that has some resource records in there, A records. Important here is the entry file server, which is actually there. And we want to make that enable that people using single label names and having no search list still being able to look that up. So it is possible to create a zone in the DNS server called global names and put the single label names that we want to resolve in there. And it is recommended to be to put that in as a C name pointing to the real A records somewhere else. But in fact, it's just a normal zone. You can just put everything in there. It's just a recommendation to put the C names in there. So here in this example, I have two C names in there. One is called FS and one is called server, and both are pointing to this file server in the AD firma.example zone. So what now happens if we use the old NS lookup, which is still the tool of choice in the Microsoft world for doing queries? If we ask for a single label name like server, we get an answer back. We get an answer back for fileserver.ad.firma.example, and we get the IP address, and we get the information that there is a C name called server.ad.firma.example, which actually does not exist. If we look in that zone, it does not exist. It's kind of automatically synthesized from this global name zone. So we never see these .globalnamezones anywhere in the in the answers. It's just that if the DNS server, the Microsoft DNS server, receives a single label request, it first tries to look up that single label request using normal DNS techniques. If that does not give an answer, it looks in this global name zone, if that zone exists. And if it finds it there, it then resolves it from there and synthesizes from the CNAME what's in there a response from the zone where the CNAME points to. This is not enabled by default. It needs to be enabled. But as a lot of companies want to go away with WINS, it will probably be enabled in a lot of installations. And it's this synthesizing of the CNAME records might be irritating if you're troubleshooting these networks. So is it useful? Especially it's useful because WINS and NetBIOS lookup won't work in IP version 6 anymore. Also, having DNS and WINS in the same network is really hard to troubleshoot. You cannot really predict which service is doing the lookup and from where you can get an answer. So going away with WINS is a good idea. Also, kind of nice is that while WINS is a Windows-only solution, this global name zone works also for other operating systems that are querying against that Windows 2008 DNS server, like Unix systems or Mac OS X systems. Apart from the global name zones, there is now full IP version 6 support, which is a good thing. So in the whole operating system, everything where you can put in an IP version 4 address, you can also use an IP version 6 address, and that is true for both the GUI and the command line utilities, which is, I think, a big step forward for IP version 6 deployment in these enterprise customer networks. It is possible in the Windows 2008 server to use IP version 6 addresses in URLs, which is this RFC 2732 RFC that is implemented here. Also, there is, because there are a lot of legacy applications that cannot work with IP version 6 addresses, there's a special thing built in the Windows 2008 server that is, if you put in a special DNS name that ends in IP version 6-literal.net, the DNS resolver will not look that up. Instead, it will convert the port that is the label that is before the IP version 6-literal.net into an IP version 6 address and is using that IP version 6 address directly without ever querying DNS at all. That is meant as a workaround for applications that can use DNS names but cannot use IP version 6 addresses. So if you need this application to contact a machine that has no name but only an IP version 6 address, you can use this literal version 6 address name. Okay, Windows 2008 now supports international domain names, which is nice. It also registers automatically by dynamic DNS update its own IP version 6 address towards its DNS server. So the same auto-registration we have for IP version 4 is also now working for IP version 6. That is part of the complete IP version 6 support now in the system. Active Directory zones are now loaded in the background. So far, that was a big problem for customers that having real big zones, because then a restart of the DNS server took maybe 30 minutes. On the next slide, I have here how it works. When the DNS server starts, it first loads the list of zones to load. Then it loads the root hints. Then it loads the file-based zone. That is still one by one. So until that, the DNS server is still starting up, and it's not answering to queries. But then in point four, after loading all static zones, it starts answering the queries. And then all remaining Active Directory integrated zones will be loaded in the background. And it works that way. If a request is coming in for a zone that is not yet loaded, that will be automatically rescheduled to be loaded first. Then the answer is sent back from that loaded zone, and then it starts loading the other zones in the normal order. There's dname support in Windows 2008 server, but only from the command line. There's no way to enter dnames in a zone from the GUI tools. You need to know where to do it on the command line. There is a feature in there that are forwarding zones, which is called conditional forwarding in the Microsoft lingo. It can now be replicated in an Active Directory. So if you have a lot of DNS servers being Active Directory integrated, you don't need to go to every one of them and configure conditional forwarding. You do it once, and then it's automatically replicated to all the DNS servers, which is nice to keep the configuration clean. Bad part is the DNSSEC report. I have searched in that, but unfortunately, there's no additional support for DNSSEC in Windows 2008. It's the same status as for Windows 2003, as far as I know. If anyone knows more about that, please let me know. And that support, which was in Windows 2003, is the old DNSSEC, so not the new DNSSEC. So I would say that DNSSEC support is not really usable there. And I think that is the last point I have. It's the read-only domain controller. It's now possible to, because some customers want to use the convenience of zone transfer by Active Directory replication, it's now possible to configure a read-only domain controller that receives DNS data by Active Directory replication that is not by normal zone transfer, but still being robust enough to be deployed on the internet. In the old world, Active Directory replication was always two-way. So if you had a DNS server out in the internet and that was being hacked, the hacker could change everything in Active Directory and that has been replicated back to the normal internal network, which was a bad thing. With a read-only domain controller, you can isolate that. So the replication directory is only from your masters to your whatever slaves or secondaries you have in the internet to face the bad world out there. Generic, not DNS-specific improvements. There is a server core installation that is like Windows without graphics for the command line people. There's no desktop, no Internet Explorer, no media player, no .NET framework, so it's much more easier to secure, which is ideal for DNS and DHCP server deployments, but you need to be able to master the command line on Windows, which is not easy. But it can be done. Also, there's a shift on how Microsoft implement things. They say now that everything can be done in Windows 2008 from the command line, and some things can be done from the GUI, which was with older Windows systems, it was the other way around. So now everything can be done from the command line and can be scripted if wanted. And there is a built-in virtual machine technology similar to VMware or similar things in there, which is nice to partition DNS servers, for example, to get customers to separate authoritative and caching DNS servers in separate logical operating system instances without having to buy more hardware. And my personal prediction is that Windows 2008 will see faster adoption in the market than like Vista, because there is some substantial value in this new thing, and we will probably see most migrations in 2009 that people really start using that in the market. That's all for now. Any questions?
Olaf Kollekman, Analog Labs. A small question prompted by your slide on dname support, where the interface doesn't allow for entering dnames, but the command line tool does. Question is, what resource record types are supported in the command line tool, or in the GUI, and which are not? And is there basic support for unknown resource records, RC 3297, I think?
No, there's only a limited set of resource records that are supported by both the GUI and the command line tool. As far as I know, no way to use resource records that are unknown to this product. And also there's no support for this additional resource records or the unknown resource records.
Will the server read zone files?
Haven't tested that. I would doubt it. We can test that and...
I would be very interested in knowing that.
Okay, I test that and send you an email.
In a different context, but let's talk offline.
Yes.
Christian?
Eric Klein, Unix Bigot. Forgive my Windows ignorance. Does they also support ASIC records?
Pardon?
You mentioned in the same vein as DNAME, do they also support ASIC records?
ASIC?
Yes.
They support Quad A, but I'm not sure about ASIC.
Say ASIC. Yes. We like ASIC. We want ASIC.
Yeah, but I'm not sure if it's supported. I have to look it up. Sorry.
Is there any sense of like, well, I mean, obviously it's there. It's probably from customer demand, I assume. Deaning?
The mic is not on, or I don't hear it. Sorry.
Sorry. Try this one.
Sorry, I was just I was going to ask you if you had any insight into like how great this demand for DNAME and things has been.
There's so far as I'm working with Windows DNS servers, that is 7 years now, we had no one customer asking for DNAME or ASIC.
So they added it anyway. Okay.
So at least from the commercial enterprise customer space, there is no demand so far. Seems to be.
Two more questions, one from an ASIC heretic, and then one from Lars Johan Lehmann.
So being open, I'm sorry, what?
What's your name?
Oh, my name is Ed Lewis. No, Bill Manning. Being open and transparent and sort of like inclusive, I tend to stick a whole bunch of different servers or service types as being authoritative for a single zone. If I put this into my cluster and the authoritative server is handing out ASIC records and NSAP PTRs and a bunch of other things which are not popular these days, will this take those records and serve them?
As a caching resolving name server. Yes.
No, not as a caching resolving name server, as an authoritative server in a cluster. I have a list of authoritative NSs, and one of these happens to be this
new thing. And you do zone transfer to that new thing.
Yeah, I will do. I'll send out a notify, and he should pick up the update.
Have to test it. Don't know.
Okay, because losing data says that, in fact, this is if that happens, then this is really targeted towards a Microsoft-only DNS cluster. You can't mix Unix and Microsoft DNS machines in the same cluster for the same zone.
Yeah, unless you restrict yourself to the resource record supported by Microsoft.
Ha!
Lima?
Lars Lima, Autonomica. What exactly did you mean by saying that it's IDN, that the server is IDN, what do you call it, compliant capable? How is that the difference from before?
It is more that not the DNS server itself is IDN compliant. The resolver in the server is IDN compliant. That you can the resolver can look up names that are entered in Unicode and can translate that correctly.
Okay, so you have all right. So So they put the IPA in the resolver instead on the application.
Yeah, so it does not send Unicode in DNS requests. It translates that correctly and sends normal DNS requests.
What does translate correctly mean? How do you know it's Unicode that's coming in? I think I would like to talk more about
yes, offline.
There's inconsistency here that I don't understand. Because to me, IDN is when you're in the DNS system, it's ASCII. And then you're
yes.
Already past the border.
Yes.
Well, Lehmann, it's Windows, so it knows everything about everything. Okay, I think we're done now. Peter, you have a question?
Yeah, of course I have a question.
Yes.
Peter Koch, Carsten, you mentioned separating the functions of the recursing server and the authoritative server. As you are aware, there's a document in the IETF, well, still stuck, that recommends restricting the accessibility of recursive name servers. And with some of the Windows name servers currently deployed in the field, there's some difficulty because it's an all or none decision. Has this improved? Can I actually restrict the recursing to particular address spaces? Or?
Not to my knowledge, no. It's still a one check mark. Switch it off or leave it on.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much, Carsten.
And thanks, Bill.
Our next speaker is Shane Kerr, who's got some interesting stories to tell us about DNS filter.
Okay, so my name is Shane Kerr. I'm working for Afilias Limited now. And this talk comes out of some work I've been doing recently analyzing some of the raw captured data that we have on our DNS servers. So basically, it's a set of rules that you can use for TCP dump filters to get a little better look at your traffic. So we run Afilias right now runs an Anycast cloud of DNS servers. Each one has a set of 7 application servers behind it, which are answering DNS queries. They're behind a pair of routers. They're behind a pair of load balancers and things like that. And we get a lot of traffic. We run a few big gTLDs and a number of ccTLDs as well. So because of this, it's impractical to store all of these queries. We actually do store all of the queries that we get, but not at each of the servers answering the DNS queries. And with all the queries that we get, it's also difficult to look at this much data. If you're doing searches for specific patterns and things like that, it just takes several minutes for each query. And when you're doing data mining and things like that, it's not very handy. We are doing some work, incidentally, to move stuff into DNS databases, but we're not quite there yet. So, and there's also a special case for us because we do a double NAT into our clusters, so source and destination IP addresses and things like that. So we actually have a specific need to match things by query ID only and time. So what's the basic approach that I ended up coming up with to actually look at this stuff and find queries? Is that it turns out that you can make PCAP filters to capture DNS packets for a specific query ID or for a specific query name and query type and query class. So, and actually the real motivation for this is we like to see DNS, occasionally we see DNSmon packets that get dropped, and we want to see where exactly, which of our servers they came into, and see what happened with each particular query. So that's the ultimate goal here. So you don't have to use TCP dump for this stuff. There are tools that exist to produce TCP dump style output specifically for DNS. There's a tool called DNSCAP. I'm not sure exactly who maintains that. It doesn't actually right now let you do filtering based on type and class. But the real motivation I didn't want to use DNSCAP for this stuff was because it failed me once the last time I used it, and I don't want to be bitten again. There's also a tool called T-Shark, which is a part of the Wireshark protocol, which is actually very, very sexy, and it will do exactly this stuff. The main reason that I decided to pursue using TCP dump for this was, well, one, it's really cool. You'll see when the rules come up later. And the other is that Wireshark isn't installed everywhere. I mean, I've got tiny little Linux routers in my home that simply can't install the Wireshark package. It's too big. There's not enough memory. But TCP dump is fairly ubiquitous. You'll find it on almost every computer that you're on if you're working in a network environment. There may be other tools to do this kind of stuff, but I didn't do too much research. I'm a bit lazy like that. So what actually does TCP dump store when it stores packets? The PCAP files, they have information about the capture with all kinds of stuff that you don't really care about, like byte ordering things and the time things started. And actually what you care about is the Ethernet packet, which is stored kind of in a raw format in there. And then an Ethernet packet in the DNS context has your Ethernet header, your IP header, and your UDP header, and then the actual DNS packet. As an aside, in this, I'm only looking at UDP. We do get TCP traffic, of course, as well, but I think like almost everyone in the universe, TCP traffic is such a small percentage, it's not really worth looking at in this case. So in order to do this kind of wacky filtering, which you'll see in the next slide, you need to know a little bit about what the DNS packet format looks like. Now, fortunately, the packet size is a bunch of fixed header fields. So you've got 2 bytes for the query ID, 2 bytes of flags and things like that, and then a bunch of counts. And then after all that fixed size, you've got the beginning of the query and answer section. And this is where it gets a little tricky because DNS queries are encoded and variable length and things like that. So, and the type of the query and the class of the query come after the name of the query, which means you can't just say, okay, I want to look for every chaos class query and look for anything like that. You actually have to query for specific names. As a quick note also, the IPv4 header lengths do vary, but TCP dump gives you an array which lets you look at specific bytes within the UDP packet. I lied, it's not the next slide yet. But each query has a variable length as I described, so it's n to 2 bytes. So as I mentioned, if you want to match specific query type or query class, you have to look for a specific name. And these names are encoded. I don't know if you can see this. You separate it with the dots, and then each label, it lists the length of the label in bytes, then the label, and then the next length, and so on. And then it ends with a 0 byte. So it's pretty straightforward. Another minor thing to be aware of is that DNS is case insensitive, but TCP dump can't be, because TCP dump is just looking at raw bytes on the wire. So it doesn't know what's a character, an ASCII character, or what's a count and things like that. So what you end up with is something that looks a bit like this. It's a big gnarly rule. And it turns out that if you cut and paste this and throw it in a TCP dump, it actually works. And so this one right here is for ID server, for type text, and class chaos. And this is what DNSmon will use when it's checking for host name. And it's a semi-standard way to do this kind of thing. So a few other quick notes. When you get a query, when the server replies, it copies the query into the answer. So when you use a query matching like the filter that you just saw, it will actually get the answers too. If you don't want the answers, then you need to do some other filtering based on source address or things like that, or destination address, things like that. Other quick note, the UDP thingy doesn't work for IPv6. There's no UDPv6 rule. Fortunately, in IPv6, the headers are a fixed length, so you can just use the offset into the IPv6 packet. Also, looking at EDNS0 is tricky because EDNS0 is not coded in one of those fixed places. It's done in an additional section, so the offset of EDNS information is kind of in an arbitrary location later on in the packet. So there's no the upshot of this is there's no simple way to say, give me all the queries with the do bit set by just looking at raw packet offsets. So I put up a little web page here. There's a little JavaScript thing that you can use to build your arbitrary rules. Check it out, it's pretty cool. And that's about it.
Okay. Thank you, Shane. Are there any questions? Lars Lehmann, again.
Lars Lehmann, of course, I have questions. I actually have two. The first one is, would it be possible to do away with the casing problem by ignoring the case bit? Because that actually corresponds to a bit in the character.
Oh, you mean to and it out? So it's you could do it that way, yeah.
Would it be a help?
I just
planting the idea in your head. I mean, it seems like you should be able to do away with half of that.
No, you wouldn't. Every line there that's kind of indented, do away with one of these.
Yes.
But you'd have to and it, and then yeah. So you do it with one of the cases, but the rule itself would be longer.
My second question was, since I'm not an IPv6 nerd, do you run into problems with these IPv6 optional headers, packet headers?
I didn't see any of those in our traffic, but I didn't specifically look. Okay. So I don't know if they're very common in use, but I haven't ever seen any. So.
Okay, thanks.
Okay, are there any more questions? One more.
Hi, Keith Mitchell, ISC. Not so much a question, just some information on DNSCAP. As far as I'm aware, it's maintained by POVIXE. You can get the code, which is kind of version 1.0, off the OARC, public.oarci.net website. If you've got any feedback or issues with it, the best place to do it is on the DNS operations at list.oarci.net. Very happy to take feedback for improvements.
Thank you, Keith.
Bill Manning. A couple of things. Extension headers for V6 probably don't show up in too much of the DNS protocol these days, except for screwball labs, because its use would be non-standard. The second is that the presumption that I have is that you're actually doing this on data you have already captured. You're not looking at this in real time.
What we do right now is on each of our servers, each of these seven servers per node that's actually answering queries, we capture all the DNSMon style traffic. So anything looking for a host name or a version or anything like that in the chaos class, we capture it to a file and we do actually capture it using this rule.
From the machines that are actually doing the DNS resolution?
Yes.
You're not, okay. That's an interesting way to do it. Other people do a BPF fork and do their logging and capturing on a machine dedicated for logging and capturing.
We also have a dedicated logging and capturing machine, but we want to see the queries actually arrive on the machine, so.
The 3/10 of a millisecond difference, I don't think is too. Anyway, but
yeah,
it's it.
Okay then, thank you very much, Shane. Yeah. Now then, we are almost up to the lunch break, and I've making an executive decision chair that rather than hold you back from your lunch by listening to Peter's very interesting presentation, we'll hold over.